On the Record.
On News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. A community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.
We are joined in studio by Killian de Goscoon, who's a member of NEFIT and he's director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory. Killian, thank you for coming in because I'm sure you're pretty busy this weather. And a lot of that business is to do with the Omicron variants. First of all, you might just tell us, before we talk about the threat that it might be and whether it might be resistant to vaccines and all the likes, what sort of work we're actually doing to try and identify whether it's already here?
Okay, thanks, Gavin. Yeah, good morning. So one of the, one of the fortunate things, in some respects, for want of a better word, about the Omicron variant is that it possesses lots of amino acid changes in the spike protein, but it possesses a number of deletions. So one of the deletions, which means a bit of the genome is missing, one of those deletions is one of the targets of one of the PCR assays that we look for in one of the assays that we're using at our NVRL lab out of Back Weston. So people might remember, unfortunately, this time last year when we were talking about the alpha variant and we were talking about things
like the UK variant at the time.
Exactly, yeah. We were talking about things like S gene target failure and S dropout and it allowed us to monitor the emergence of alpha in near real time. First, they were using it in the UK, they were using the Thermo Fisher TACPath assay in their Pillar 2 labs, and then we were bringing that assay on stream in Back Weston in January.
So in an accessible way, basically, that it shares some of the characteristics of alpha and it means then that you're already on the lookout for it or that it's easier to spot.
So fortunately, in some respects, so when Delta appeared, Delta doesn't have that deletion.
Okay.
So therefore, when we were using this assay, it's a three-target assay. It looks for three targets, and if it detects all three of them, we knew it was Delta, and we were able to monitor that transition from Alpha to Delta. And we know now that Omicron has this deletion again, so it's purely serendipitous in some respects, but it does allow us to monitor this in real time. So what we're doing at the moment, in line with the public health guidance that has been issued over the last 24-48 hours, now it's important to clarify that not all of the testing is done at Back Weston. Okay. Obviously there are lots of labs doing testing, but from the point of view of just a general surveillance look and see, we're going back to the 1st of November. So we're currently reviewing the data from the 1st of November just to see if we any of this pattern.
Okay.
So the deletion,
and is that targeted or is it just a general troll? Like are you looking at specific cases or
everything? It's just general troll. So obviously the Omicron variant was only reported really this week. So now what we can do prospectively is we can continue to do that surveillance work, and then anything that exhibits that pattern of S dropout or S gene target failure will go on for whole genome sequencing. But equally then we can do targeted testing. So, for example, travel-associated cases can be redirected to the Back Weston laboratory.
Might that be, if you're looking at travel-related cases, might that be a little bit of a case of closing the stable door after the horse has departed? Because if we know now that there are some examples of it in some isolated countries in Europe, at least they've found some cases, but there's nothing to say that there aren't quite a few more out there in the wild. And that if you were to look at something which is specifically targeted to travellers from Southern Africa, the chances are that you could be missing it in travellers from Europe.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you've hit the nail on the head. I think like the key thing is really we want to reduce the risk of importation and reduce the number of imported cases. We may not capture every imported case, but I think the key thing is it's still far better to import only 100 cases than to import 1,000 cases. So really the pre-travel PCR, the post-travel quarantine, those measures are really important. But what we will be doing is any travel associated case, because you're right, we can't, you know, we saw this back at the start of the pandemic when we were looking specifically at travel, say with China and then various other countries, you will miss things because the virus is more likely more widespread than it has been. Because one of the interesting things from the virus perspective with this new variant is that it's not something that is built onto Alpha. It's not something that is built onto Delta. So it's not a Delta plus or anything. If we look at the sequence of this virus and track it back, it actually probably emerged in the middle of 2020. So the question for us as virologists is what's it been doing since then? It's obviously been acquiring mutations, unfortunately.
Yeah. But you think it's been out there in the wild somewhere in the world for that long?
So there are two options. So either, yes, it's been circulating somewhere in the world that doesn't have surveillance, that just hasn't, so it's been going at a low level and undetected, and presumably wasn't as transmissible back then. So it's obviously been evolving over that period of time. And then the second option is that it's been circulating perhaps in chronically infected individuals who may be immunocompromised, and therefore it would have circulated in those individuals, continued to evolve in the setting of a suboptimal immune response, and now has spilled over back into the population and obviously appears to have kicked off in South Africa.
So, and obviously then we're talking about parts of the world that don't have the same vaccine uptake as we have in Europe or in parts of the North Hemisphere, the Western world as well. There's some theory that actually mass vaccination means that viruses there's the argument that, of course, a virus is more likely to mutate in somebody who hasn't received a vaccine because they've got no artificial kind of protection against it. But there's also an argument that actually the adoption of vaccines means that viruses end up becoming maybe more resilient, that it almost fast tracks any kind of evolution or mutations that they have. Is there an argument to that?
Yeah, so this is the type of conversation that we probably don't have time for today. Yeah. But it is really fascinating.
The positive version of it.
So we have other seasonal human coronaviruses. We have four that cause the common cold. They cause a mild illness. We don't know when they cross the species barrier, but we all know they cross the species barrier at some point. So you could make a case that that's the end point for SARS-CoV-2 as well, if we were to sit back and do nothing. Obviously, we can't do that. So you're right. We're intervening with therapies. We're intervening with vaccines. Mm. So we're changing that natural process. So whether that makes it more painful in the short term, as you said, whether it drives a virus, it puts in an unnatural evolutionary pressure, if you like, by administering vaccine. But it's obviously still the right thing to do. And really, the question is what impact it has on how long it takes to get that equilibrium. Because from a virus perspective, we're still a very new host for it. It's still only two. It's been a really long 2 years for us. But the virus is really only getting started in a new host. Mm.
And I will talk about what it might mean for Ireland, the management and interventions, and what that might mean practically on the ground. But just to thrash that out to maybe a bit of a conclusion, is that to say then that at some point, if you do put a virus under pressure, that if it feels pressured to evolve in that way, that at some point then you will actually get to its kind of its final state, that it might sort of reach a point where more evolutions are unlikely, and that's when it becomes endemic and it's just kind of background noise to our lives?
Potentially. So the virus needs to be able to get into our cells, needs to be able to infect us. So there is a limited number of changes that it can make. Now, I don't know what that number is, and it will continue to evolve over time. But based on, and people will again be familiar with this, the spike protein, which is on the surface of the cell, it's what on the surface of the virus, and what the virus uses to get into our cells, and it's associated with infectivity, transmissibility, and it's also in our vaccines. It still needs to get access to the cell. It has a receptor. So unless the virus were to completely change and use another receptor, which really doesn't happen, then it really has to sort of stick with that spike protein. But at this end, there's, as I said, a finite number of mutations that it can make. But at the same time, if you look at something similar, like, say, our seasonal influenza, it's a different virus, obviously, and it mutates more quickly. Mm. But that's continued to evolve over many decades. But you're right. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is get to a stage where this whatever virus emerges at the end causes mild illness. It may be very transmissible. Mm. The immune response may not last terribly long. But if the illness is very mild, then we don't really care too much about that.
Well, that's what the advice of Dr. Angelique Coetzee, the Pretoria-based GP, we were speaking to her in the first hour of the programme. You can listen back to that, by the way, on newstalk.com or through the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And she was saying that, yes, it seems to be, by their evidence, it seems to be more transmissible, but that the illness that people present with is more to do with exhaustion and general bodily aches and pains. In fact, I know this is a dangerous comparison, but you might actually compare it to the disease you get from the flu. So, you know, is there a prospect that maybe this is coming towards that sort of the point where the virus has evolved to become more transmissible but loses its potency along the way?
I think that, so yeah, no, I heard her this morning and that's very interesting. I think it's probably wishful thinking that we're there at that stage. So there is, again, there's a general theory that over, given a long enough period of time, viruses will evolve to become maybe more transmissible, maybe but less severe. Okay. But the reason for that, if you think about it at a population level, is because, and in the absence of intervention, what's happened is that it's the virus has killed all the susceptible people.
Okay.
So the people that have survived and procreated are the ones that have immunity and that are able to tolerate the infection. And that doesn't happen in 2 years typically. So it may well happen in the longer term, but I think it's probably wishful thinking to think we're there at this stage.
In principle then, how long will it be before we are able to identify for certain whether this variant might be vaccine resistant or whether the amount of mutations that it has will actually mean that the technologies we have at our disposal today aren't going to work for it?
So those, my understanding, so basically in order to do that work, you need a virus isolate. You need to grow up the virus in cell lines in the laboratory setting. My understanding is that South Africa has already started that work. The UK is trying to source some isolates from Southern Africa, and maybe obviously they have a couple of their own cases now.
Effectively, you need to grow it in a lab to be able to test it to see.
Exactly. And certainly the amino acid changes or the mutations that it has are concerning. But I think it's important to remember that what we're looking at here is a virus that's very different to the original Wuhan virus, just for want of a better phrase. But equally, Alpha was very different to Wuhan. Delta was more different to Wuhan. And what we've seen is that the vaccines still retain an effectiveness against those variants, certainly against severe illness and against hospitalization. So what I would envisage, and again, I'm not trying to predict the future because there's an awful lot of people, there's a risk of sort of saying, nobody knows what's going to happen with Omicron as it spreads. But it certainly isn't implausible that if it's more transmissible, it may certainly may cause more infections, but actually there's no reason to believe that the cellular arm of the immune system won't be effective at protecting against severe disease and hospitalization. It may not be as effective as they are against Delta or against Alpha or against the original virus.
But they'll still do something.
It's hard to imagine that they wouldn't, to be honest.
Yeah, but then all of that brings us then to the question that a lot of people might be wondering, which is what ultimate interventions Ireland might need to do. I know that we've obviously intervened and we've tried to stop travel to stop this from seeding in as much as you can in the short term. But people say, well, if actually it's more transmissible and the disease maybe is that bit milder and what we're doing is already going to be fairly effective, do we need to do much more to worry about this? Does this actually change the game very much at all?
I suppose, to my mind, at this stage, we need to operate on the basis that it could change the game dramatically, because we saw what happened with Delta in the context of transmissibility. This virus, based on what we know at this point and based on what's been reported in South Africa, at least, or in Southern Africa, is that it's far more widespread at this stage. It's far more transmissible, at least as transmissible as Delta, if not more so. And ultimately, bear in mind that not everybody is going to have a robust enough immune system. So what we have seen over the past 2 years is that increased number of cases does ultimately, depending, obviously the conversion factor may change,
but ultimately but it does have some link with hospitalization.
Exactly, at least increased hospitalization. So we need to be very careful about sort of just, we can't afford to just, I suppose, sit back and let it rip until certainly until we know far more about it.
Sorry, I probably should have maybe got a concrete answer on the previous question, which is with all that lab work going on to figure out whether vaccines are fully as effective or how effective will they be, when might we begin to expect some concrete information on that?
Oh, we'd certainly hope to see something probably within the next 2 to 4 weeks, I would think. So assuming everything goes according to plan, because the studies themselves don't take a huge amount of time, but it's about growing up the virus, making sure that it's robust, making sure that it survives in the lab and getting it up and running.
Do you have any theories as a whole as to why we thought at the start of August that we were going to be maybe in the clear of all of this, that we thought that we were going to be over the crest of a wave, that we thought that general infections were going to be on the down low and that we could go back to full normality, and why so quickly then things to seem to go off the rails again?
For me, ultimately, it's a combination of things. Primarily, it comes back to the virus. It's an incredibly transmissible virus. And if we look at what happened over the course of the summer, when we, you know, it was really after the June bank holiday weekend, we saw that flip from Alpha to Delta, and then it just became dominant. And then I think we also have opened up society to an incredible degree compared to where we would have been this time last year.
But it seemed like at the start of October, we were fully prepared for the reopening of settings that we know can be dangerous. The likes of nightclubs in certain circumstances, nightclubs, it's evidential around the world that nightclubs are a pretty, you know, pretty good example of how it will spread. And at the start of August, we thought we were going to be OK to open them for all come the 22nd. And then only by 2 weeks later, suddenly we were going, hang on, things have gone off the rails there. Like, it can't have changed that quickly. So was it other just societal behaviours? Did we go indoors and not factor in how much it makes a difference if you're not going to be outdoors as much?
And I think so. Yeah, this was the elements. So for me, one of the virus, one of the social is the increased socialisation, and the other is the vaccine effectiveness. Because bear in mind again that the vaccine studies were all done with, you know, pre-alpha and alpha predominantly, and then we saw over time that the vaccine effectiveness waned with Delta. And really, while we had an incredibly high uptake in the course of people's primary courses, what we've seen now is that in reality the primary course for these vaccines is probably 3 doses, and that's, I think, when we get to everybody with 3 doses and everybody's been boosted, I think then we'll be in a better position to see exactly what the future looks like. But I do think we have seen, while we obviously expected people to increase their socialization, I think we've seen that the vaccines weren't as protective against infection and against transmission as we thought they might be in the context of those people who do get infected. They're obviously very effective against preventing people getting infected in the first place, but once people are infected, they're well able to transmit.
What is the short-term outlook? I know that you're probably not going to breach the confidence of what NPHET is going to discuss or the substance of it, but just as a stance right now, there was a statement last night from the Department of Health saying that NPHET's epidemiological teams were meeting over the weekend. Is activity behind the scenes being stepped up to both in light of Omicron and the general situation on the ground anyway?
A yes is a short answer, but Omicron, I suppose, is what would have brought it to a head. Obviously, NPHET would have met on Thursday anyway, so typically there would have been nothing scheduled for this weekend had events on Thursday and Friday suddenly not changed. So I think what we're seeing, I suppose, the key message for people at the moment, so Omicron is a concern and we need to pay attention to it and we need to monitor it, but we're still in the middle of a very significant Delta wave that we need to control first, because what we're seeing in Southern Africa, they had really come through their Delta wave when Omicron emerged. So we don't know yet what Omicron does when it's, you know, plonked into the middle of a Delta wave. It may well outcompete it, but it's not going to outcompete it overnight. So what people need to do in the context of, we've still got about 4,500 cases per day, we've more than 500 people in hospital, more than 100 people in intensive care, we can't plateau at this level, and we certainly can't bring in a new, more transmissible variant and let that become dominant from this level. So we really need to continue to control what we have while being vigilant and monitoring Omicron.
Does that mean then, and without prejudging whatever NPHET might decide in the next couple of days, does that mean that there would be some logic to replicating what the UK has done by means of trying to restrict travel as much as you can, but then requiring PCR tests for all arrivals and asking them to isolate in the meantime?
Yeah, I think like it's a question of getting the balance right between what's feasible to do and what's important to do. So I think from our perspective, we want to minimise the risk of importing cases of Omicron from wherever they may originate. But equally, we need people to continue to follow the public health measures that are in place here, to come forward and get vaccinated if they haven't started their course, to come forward for their boosters if and when they're offered. But I think ultimately, like, what we need to be thinking about, setting aside Omicron, what we need to be thinking about as a society is the next 3 months, December, January, February. That's our winter. Like, before we ever had a pandemic, our winters are really, really put pressure on the healthcare system. We didn't have any influenza last year. We didn't have any RSV last year. We didn't have any of the other respiratory viruses circulating last year. They are coming back. RSV, we've had a significant surge in children over the last 6 to 8 weeks, and we would expect to see influenza. So rather than, I suppose, looking at the short term elements in relation to Christmas or whatever it might be, we need to be thinking as a society about the next 3 months and as individuals about what we can do safely over the next 3 months.
Christmas is traditionally, though, a time of a lot of international travel, so ought there to be, and this won't be an easy thing for a lot of people to stomach, but ought there to be some inhibitions on how freely people can travel internationally?
So I suppose you're right. I don't want to preempt what discussions will be had over the coming weeks. And I think realistically, we obviously want to give advice as soon as we can. But in the context of Omicron, we'll know more, you know, in a week's time and in 2 weeks' time, in the context of where it's been detected around the world. And we might have some more sort of preliminary data on what's happened from a laboratory perspective as to whether it does have an impact on the vaccine effectiveness. Because the other thing we haven't seen yet is disease severity. As people will know, there's often a lag between case numbers and hospitalizations. So the fact that South Africa has really just reported their increase in case numbers this week, that knock-on effect to hospitalizations and intensive care admissions, we're not going to see that for another week or two.
Somebody gets in touch with the question about, you said that maybe a three-course booster might actually, or three-course vaccine might actually just be the full course of it. What reason we might have to be confident that actually three doses would be enough, that three would actually be the cap on it, or that we wouldn't need another one next summer or next winter again?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I can't say with certainty. Like, we look at the data and the impact that boosters appear to have had, certainly in Israel and the UK, and even in our own older population. It seems to be providing a very robust immune response. Typically, we have seen with other vaccines that if you've a three, or depending on what the original course is, whether it's three or four doses, just for argument's sake, it's typically that final dose that gives you that longevity and that durability of response. So that person's absolutely correct. But I think what we can do, if we get everybody to complete the primary course of three doses, then it's likely that would give us a year or two of protection, and whether that needs to be boosted again at some point, it may well come up. But no, they're right. We can say for definite that it will be three and done.
With that, which kind of brings me then to what I think would probably be the last question, which is that if there isn't necessarily some point where we discover that a third or a fourth dose is the one that gives you much more long-lasting protection, the best estimate is that even if you've had COVID, that it gives you natural antibodies for about 9 months, and then maybe you're susceptible to catching it a second time. Is that basically the dance that we're going to be in, that it's going to either be you catch it and you deal with whatever symptoms there might be, or you get a vaccine every 9 or 12 months until we reach a time where we figured out that vaccines do actually provide semi-permanent protection?
So yes is the short answer to a long question. But yeah, what we're trying to figure out, I think it's really important that people, I suppose, remember that we're only 2 years into this. So therefore, and we only, you know, the vaccine trials only came out in the second half of 2020. So by definition, we've only been able to track those individuals for coming up on probably 15, 18 months at this stage. And we'll continue to monitor them over time. But if we look at where we have our seasonal human coronaviruses at the moment, they call it mild illness. Anybody who's had a cold and has had recurrent colds knows that typically the immunity doesn't last for very long. Now, that said, we wouldn't always have characterized those as seasonal human coronaviruses. So there are other viruses that can cause a common cold, yeah. But setting that aside, so realistically, this will more than likely become an endemic virus. But what we want to do is ensure that when people are exposed to the virus itself for the first time, that they are as protected as they can be. And we're doing that with vaccination, because at this stage, it really is the fact that the virus has become so established in the human population after crossing the species barrier is that everybody will likely become exposed at some point. And what we want to do is to make sure that when you do become exposed for the first time, that you've had the vaccine to prime your immune system, so therefore you're less likely to get severe disease and you're less likely to go into hospital.
Kilian de Goscuin, Director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory at UCD and a member of NEFIT, thank you very much for coming in this lunchtime.